Hi, this is Dawn Shireen, and this is my podcast, Dancing with Bipolar. Well, today is October 10th, and it is National Mental Health Day. So, in honor of this, I have a special guest today. His name is Scott Silverman. He is the author of Tell Me No, I Dare You, A Guide for Living a Heroic Life. Scott has also received numerous accolades and awards, including the CNN Hero of the Week. He is the founder of Second Chance Program. And Scott is also a crisis coach, a behavioral health advisor, and leads the team at Confidential Recovery. So he's got quite a list of stuff. So everybody, let's welcome Scott.
Yes. Hello.
Good morning.
How are you?
Good. That worked.
Can you hear me?
I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can very well. Yeah, I'm glad it worked. The tech issues are always the thing that I'm like most. I'm like, oh my God, please work. So I'm glad. So how are you today, National Mental Health Day?
Oh, very, very well. Feel much better today. Thank you. How about you?
I'm doing excellent. So I just wanted to briefly touch on what it is that has brought you to where you are now. And then you told me to get you some hardball questions. So I think that I was very successful in that. So let's start with, you know, what it is that made you want to help the mental health community and your own history.
Well, that's a great question. And I think, I don't know if really one starts out with this design to help the, you know, help a specific group with a specific issue. I think for me, it's evolved over time. And what I've just learned about being of service and what I've learned anecdotally and experientially is my own personal journey around substance abuse and addiction and my own attempt of taking my own life kind of added up to you know, I need some help. And as I sought help and I spoke with others and I learned how to better live, I call it life on life's terms, and how to process the things that, you know, I felt they were being thrown at me. But what I learned is, in the journey of life, some things are thrown at you, some things just fall on your head, and some things you tend to, you know, draw like a magnet. And as I learned how to sort out what to do as those things, you know, stepped in front of my path, or I turned in a direction that probably wasn't appropriate, I was able to facilitate processing them differently. And a lot of that came from mental health providers. A lot of it came from my own personal experience and treatment around my substance abuse, and also learning through self-help, other organizations, anonymous programs, and talking to others and being willing to say, I don't know. And more importantly, being able to say, I need help. And those are the kind of tools that I share with everyone today, is that, you know, we cannot do life alone, in my opinion, and expect things to just change without some form of interaction with others.
Right. I like to say that the surest way to stay stuck is not to move. So, you know, it like makes perfect sense. Now, you and I do have a commonality in the fact that we're both suicide survivors. Do you want to touch a little bit on your suicide attempt and, you know, not exactly everything that brought you to that point, but what brought you to that point and how you felt afterwards, not committing the act of suicide?
You know, you kind of broke up there a bit, but I think I heard you say, you know, what brought me to that point.
Right. And,
you know, I grew up in a family, I would call it a traditional family. But then, of course, I've learned that that in its own right may be, you know, a little bit of a misunderstanding. But, you know, there's four kids. My parents, they worked hard their whole life. And, you know, we all were like little soldiers. We had our roles and our job descriptions, I called it, because it was a family business. We used to have these dinners, and I called them family meetings, because we'd go around kind of like a board meeting checking in, and I was the black sheep, so I never enjoyed checking in. You know, in my early teens, I started experimenting with alcohol, and, you know, just finding that once I anesthetized myself where I felt numb, everything seemed to go better, and I didn't have to worry about yesterdays or think about tomorrows. And I enjoyed that feeling. And I was one of those, you know, according to science, 15% of the populations that was predisposed with this disease of addiction. And, you know, without going into a lot of detail, and I'm always happy to talk with somebody if they want to call me. And if you don't mind, I'm going to give my number now. It's area code 619-993-2738, 619-993-2738. 993-2738. Because I love to put my number out there to encourage people to know that, you know, it's okay to call or text me. Let's talk about it. So as I progressed with my, you know, desire to be, I called it, you know, wanted to be high, but I didn't realize the numbing effect it was having on me till later in life. And I just started to progress from alcohol and got involved with marijuana, and then quickly got introduced to methamphetamine, and then graduated to cocaine. Then we got involved with hallucinogens. And, you know, I was working every day, you know, functioning. So
functioning,
I had this, you know, outcome on a daily routine that, you know, things were going fine. I was, you know, generating an income. I was putting money in the bank. I had a car. You know, I didn't have any of those, you know, yet. And I started to, you know, didn't have any car accidents, wasn't really arrested. Then I became a unlicensed pharmacist. I'm now a retired unlicensed pharmacist, and so I've met a lot of interesting people, because, you know, being in San Diego, where I grew up, and I'm still here, you know, we're a border town, and methamphetamine was coming across the border in a big way, and I made a lot of new friends that way, and I seemed very popular, and, you know, that my business kind of grew on the sideline. So I, you know, here I am, I'm thinking, you know, I'm trudging along, and my life seems to be going pretty well. But I didn't, you know, didn't put two and two together that almost every waking hour I was anesthetized. Right. So that just progressed and got worse. And eventually it got to a point where I was on a business trip when I was 30, and I had in New York with a group of people, the family business. I was in charge of one of the groups. And I had a week of blackouts. It was horrible, and got in a fight and was picked up by the police. And, you know, my last morning in the city, I just knew that I had to figure out how I was going to explain where I'd been for 5 days. I literally got ghost and was in blackout drinking all week. And I was so upset and depressed about it that, you know, when I was at this guy's office before the meeting, I couldn't breathe. I smelled like alcohol. I looked like hell. And I just, you know, I went to the window to just, which happened to be open. It was a warm day in November in New York. And I'm sitting on the ledge and I'm thinking, you know, I can't do this again. How am I going to explain this to everybody? My family, my coworkers, my colleagues, you know, the people in the showroom that were waiting for me. I was presenting that morning. And I started to just close my eyes and realize that if I just lean back out of this window, I'm 44 floors up in middle of Manhattan. There's no way I'd ever have to explain myself ever again. And this little voice in the back of my head, it was my mom's voice. Because, you know, most of us who experience some sort of trauma, we say out loud to others, you know, maybe I'll just kill myself.
Yep.
I don't mean to say that jokingly, but I said it. I wrote notes as a kid. I ran away.
Yep.
And I heard my mom's voice, because she said, you know, suicide is selfish, son. And then as I'm hearing her voice, this guy is walking in the office. It's his office. And he goes, what are you doing? You're going to fall out the window. So I'm just getting some air. I'll be right in. You know, and I call that divine intervention. So I just decided to not lean back. And I moved forward, got in his chair, and I started to break down and cry. And I called my wife. I think it was like 8:30, you know, East Coast time. I woke her up at 5:30. I've been calling her all week in my blackouts. And each day when I checked back in, she reminded me about the conversations we'd had in the middle of the night. And I told her, I said, look, I just had a horrible episode here. I can't go into it right now, but I want you to call Gary. He was my psychiatrist at the time, who was trying to guide me, and tell him I'm ready to go. And I said, I'll call you in 2 hours and we'll make a plan. So I did. And I flew home that night, sat with my family, disclosed everything. And that next morning I was checked into a treatment center. And from that day forward, that was November the 10th, 1984. And my sobriety date actually is November 13th, because they had me on prescription medication for a couple of days. So I started my sobriety date when I got off the medication after my detoxing, and all goes well. This November I'll be celebrating 35 years.
Yep.
continue sobriety. So that's, you know, that's kind of my story, Don, and I'm sticking to it because so far I can still remember it, and I try not to ever forget it. And the reason is that I believe, you know, look, I'm 65 this year. I was expected to expire at 30, the way I was living my life and drinking and drugging. And when I hit 30 and I tried to take my own life and I got sober, I've been grateful for that ever since. And I volunteered for decades. And now I'm professionally in the business of helping others because I can leverage my expertise more. And I do everything I can every day when I wake up to try to help someone else.
That's cool. So with your role at Confidential Recovery, do you deal much with the dual diagnosis, or is this strictly for addiction issues?
Well, Confidential Recovery is a traditional certified license, they call it, but California, they call it certified outpatient facility. We're a small little boutique operation. We do intensive outpatient, and then partial hospitalization. And we do a, you know, traditional outpatient, meaning we're not detox, we're not residential. And what we try to do is then help keep people, you know, in the portal so they're tethered. So as they progress, you know, with their recovery, and we're not a traditional anonymous program or non-anonymous program. We believe we meet people where they're at. And I got into that business because I really just wanted to try to help affect change, you know, on a more consistent basis. But to answer your question, I've never met anybody who had an issue with substance abuse and addiction that once you removed I call it the anesthesia, you started to deal with the real core issues. And nobody, in my opinion, is not co-occurring. Meaning, if you're anesthetizing yourself, and I use the word anesthetizing, everyone knows what anesthesia does. It basically puts you out or numbs you, that you are moving away from something, running away from something, or trying to hide from something, or don't know what that something is, and whatever it is, you don't want it, you know, embracing you. And I'm using some very generic terms for clearly obvious reasons.
Right.
And my point is, everybody has other issues, whether it's some sort of disorder, bipolar, anxiety, depression, you know, or some sort of untreated trauma, which contributes and complicates and multiplies the pain that an individual is going through. And if it goes untreated, it doesn't get better. It just gets worse. So yes, to your question, everybody has co-occurring issues, and it would be really rare for someone to say they don't, and they may not know what they're actually, you know, going on, what's going on. So we take the position until a client unveils what's going on. And then part of our job is to help them navigate getting to the core issues. But you really can't treat any kind of behavioral health, in my opinion. And I'm not a clinician and I'm not a doctor, but you really can't treat it until you remove the mood altering substances or if somebody's self-medicating, because you can't get to the heart, to the mind, and the soul if somebody's under the influence. I mean, I get calls all the time at weird times of the night. I never respond to them. And I text them back in the morning and say, after your coffee or breakfast, please recontact me. Because there's no sense in talking to somebody when they're under the influence. You know, unless they're on the ledge, so to speak, like I was. And then you do whatever you can. And I've done it before. I tell people, look, it's in the middle of the night. You need to go back inside, get some sleep. Let's talk in the morning. They go, really? I go, yeah. But, you know, I've hit critical situations where if I wasn't there holding their hand virtually, something catastrophic might have happened. So, but, you know, that's not my specialty, dealing with someone who's at that point. But I certainly intervene when I can, and I jump in and help whenever I'm called.
So I was reading some of your other interviews and listening to some of the podcasts, and you had something about the politics of addiction, which are barriers to treatment. Can you get into that a little bit more?
Well, I think, you know, to that point, I think when the term politics, it's like, for example, abstinence-based programs, traditional, you know, 12-step programs have a philosophy of how they believe that, you know, and I'm a result, and I get in trouble whenever I say this publicly, but I don't care anymore, because this anonymity of keep being secret, in my opinion, contributes to some of the barriers that people have to getting additional support, specifically behavioral health support, mental health support, because the thinking is, well, if you go to, you know, if you go to meetings and you get a sponsor and you work the steps, everything will be fine. And you know what? It's hugely successful. And yep, there's a lot of great tools. But the problem with that, not the problem, the limitation or the politics of that is, if somebody has underlying issues, that simply praying about it or talking to someone else about it isn't enough, and they really need some form of a higher level of help, whether it's through an addiction psychiatrist or a psychologist or a mental health provider or an expert in mindfulness or somebody who deals with yoga or meditation or a faith-based guidance, whatever it might be, they should be comfortable in knowing it's okay to ask for that help as well. So that's probably the piece here I think you're referring to, is the politics around it. And for example, in treatment today, the term harm reduction or medication-assisted treatment, you know, is being introduced. It has been for over a decade or more, in some cases decades, as a tool. Meaning, if you're an opioid, we use addicted individual, you know, one of the toughest drugs to, you know, withdraw from is heroin, historically. And, you know, the funny thing is, it's the most difficult, but it happens the quickest. But still, there are tools out there today that exist that are, you know, FDA approved, the CDC says they're okay, the Surgeon General says they're okay, they're tried and true. I mean, methadone is a harm reduction tool. And some people believe that methadone is only synthetic heroin, and technically it is, medically. But at the end of the day, if methadone dosing helps somebody stay clean and manage their life, that's a great tool. But in abstinence-based programs, methadone technically is frowned upon. And, you know, I'm not somebody who was a big supporter of it until I learned about how well it can work with some people. Suboxone is another tool. Vivitrol is another tool. And these are just medications that people can take that help them deal with the not only the withdrawal process, but also the addictive side of it, and also the ability to block the craving that goes on with a lot of medication.
Right. So I've never been an opioid user. So, well, thank God, right? Because I did use everything else that was possible. But like, I drew my line on that. Like, I was always told my friends, if you ever see me doing a heroin, you need to pick me up, put me in the car, and take me to treatment right now, because that's my sign that I'm going downhill, that I just give up. But isn't it like the methadone and the Suboxone? I know people that have become addicted to that. So it's kind of a catch-22. And is there at any point in time when the physical cravings actually do stop for opioids, or is it always, you know, constantly like, you know, ringing in your head that you want to get high, you want to get high?
Well, and by the way, it's interesting because I never did opioids either. I smoked them, but I never, I was afraid of needles as a kid.
Me too.
You know, back in my day, heroin, you know, rarely was smoked. It was pretty much injected. You were an IV heroin user, or you weren't a heroin user. Yep. And that's a whole culture in its own right. But let me answer your question like this. When somebody is on Subutex, Suboxone, methadone, or Vivitrol, which is an injection, you know, that lasts for 30 days and has to be replaced, just like methadone has to be dosed pretty regularly.
Daily.
And,
yep.
and there's tapering down. There are people who actually get on it to deal with the craving. Then they taper their dosing. The dosing, you know, eventually can stop. But for some people, the way the cravings are managed is through the dosing or the taking of the harm reduction medication. So the problem is this. Some people physically, when they don't have, I'm going to use the word tool because I'm not a doctor, they don't have that tool, the cravings don't go away. I mean, I've been sober a long time. Do I have using dreams? I do. Are they frequent? No. But, you know, I'll even wake up, you know, potentially sweating, thinking, oh my God, did I go out and use? So what happens for somebody like myself who's wired that way? I don't have cravings, you know, like I used to, and I you know, it was clearly part of my daily routine to make sure I did everything I could to not let those cravings enter my body, mind, and soul. But sometimes they do, especially for someone who's been on, let's say, prescription medication. as needed and prescribed. So if somebody's taking, you know, methadone, or someone's taking Suboxone, you know, a buprenorphine or something like that, is being given by a doctor and is dosed medically and supervised, it's harm reduction. It's medication assisted treatment. It's okay, in my opinion. Now, I know I could probably argue with abstinence based providers all day long, but listen to this, Don. You know, according to science, you know, here we are in 2019. According to science, if you go through a 28-day inpatient program, anybody, 28 days, and then after 28 days, you do absolutely nothing, nothing, no meetings, no follow-ups, no meditation, no journaling, no, you know, medication, mm-hmm. nothing, you have a 95% chance of relapsing.
Yep. Okay. I thought it might be actually a higher number than that, like, you know, 99%, because without any kind of support, you can get clean because you're in a program and you have no access to drugs while you're in there. And I've known people that have half-assed it all the way through treatment, just barely doing enough to get by without getting, you know, thrown out of the treatment. But I've been in treatment, and you know, the third time was a charm for me, but the first two times I just went because it was an insurance issue and I wasn't going to be able to stay on my psych meds if I didn't do this. My psych meds, which I was also abusing, you know, so it goes into that too. But yeah, 95%, you know, recidivism? I mean, that's crazy. And that's definitely a loop in the social services too, right? I mean, because they're supposed to keep contact with you. And I know when I came out of treatment, I was supposed to see a psychiatrist and a therapist within a week of being released. And, you know, most places are or are not like that, where they have a backup plan for you.
Well, that's because insurance doesn't pay for it. So it traditionally doesn't do it. But what I want to get back to in the 95%, you know, relapse rate, you know, or recidivism rate, is what's fascinating is when you read across all the barriers, you know, whether it's, you know, the University of Albuquerque, or, you know, I think it's Georgetown back east. There's a big university that studied this for decades. The data shows that it doesn't matter what program you are in. The 95% relapse rate is across the board, meaning if you are just in a traditional 12-step program or a faith-based program or a Buddhist program or a Jewish program or a Catholic or a Christian or, you know, Native American, it doesn't matter what the program is. If you don't participate, the recidivism rate is the same, which is interesting. And according to, you know, there's a couple of documentaries out there. I'm not going to name them, but you can find them, that according to the science, if you do nothing, you have a 5% chance of getting and staying clean. So what's interesting is, so far, we as a planet haven't found a particular path that works for everybody. So it is something that you have to stay working at. And here's what I want to do before we jump off this point, assuming you're going to make me jump off this point. But when you look at, and I like to, when I talk about the disease of addiction around substance abuse, you know, that again, as you said, once that's dealt with, then you, part of the reason, my opinion, is the relapse happens is we're not necessarily focused on the co-occurring issues, the underlying issues, because you can't address them in the first 28 days. Mm-hmm. Because most people who have been under the influence for over a decade, it takes them a few months just to get rid of the fog.
Yep.
To be cognitively aware enough to be able to start processing the underlying issue.
Okay, well...
you only get 30 minutes, huh?
You know, I wonder if that's actually what it is. No, that's not true, because the last interview I did, we went for almost 44 minutes. So okay. I'm not sure what it is. That's why I keep on saying the tech is just like the part of it that I just could do without all this tech stuff. But
got it.
Anyway, do you remember the point that you were making?
I do. So what I was saying is, until the gods in heaven separated us, is when you look at the disease of addiction with substance abuse and mood altering substances, okay, when you look at that and you define it as an addiction, you know, and it's also defined as a disease, when you look at the parallel I love to compare it to is diabetes. if you and I were talking about diabetes, first of all, it'd be accepted by everybody.
Right.
Secondly, if someone thinks they have diabetes or they don't know what they actually have, they go immediately to a doctor. They get an appointment, as realistic period of time as possible. When they walk in the office, no one's questioning them and asking them, you know, why they did what they did to their life. How did you get here? Just go, I'm not feeling well. Something's going on. They examine you. They do blood work. They do a UA and they find out, you know, you have diabetes. Oh, then the doctor designs a treatment program for you after the intake and assessment. And says, you know, you're going to need to monitor your blood sugar levels today and more than likely for the rest of your life. Yeah. You know, and when you do, check your blood sugar levels, you're going to be administering insulin into your body daily as needed. And you're going to be able to live a normal life. So if you looked at the disease of addiction the same way, it's basically the same thing. No one's ever made a conscious decision that I've ever met and said, hey, mom, can I have diabetes for the rest of my life? Or, or hey, dad, I'd like to get, you know, addicted to heroin so I could mess up my journey and all of yours, too. So yep. It's not a conscious decision. It's just some of us are predisposed to have certain things. Like, you know, some of us are taller, some are thinner, some are not, some run fast, some don't, some are good students, some aren't, some are great singers, some aren't, some can play guitar, you know, just extrapolate out any way you want to. So the fact that we're even having this conversation, Don, is really, I'm grateful for it because, you know, 10 years, this conversation might have been had, but it would have been a 30-second spot. And it would have run once and it would have been buried in the archives. So the good news is, I think as a community and as a society, we're starting to open up. But there's still people out there who simply say, well, if you didn't pick up a drink, you wouldn't have a drinking problem.
Right.
You know, harm reduction is not the way to go. Okay, I hear you. But you know what? This person might need it. Do you mind if they do that? Well, okay. And I think we just need to start with, well, it's whatever it takes. I mean, right now in this country alone, okay, 240 people are dying every day, 240 people behind opioids, just opioids. And the majority of that's prescription, the rest of it's street opioids. And now, and this data was started to, you know, grow on its trajectory before fentanyl was even introduced in the mass way it's coming around to our country right now. And then we have counterfeit medication like we've never seen before, where kids are taking Xanax because they heard Xanax was a good high, unbeknownst to them, that their supplier or their distributor had their Xanax made with counterfeit pill mills, and they put fentanyl in it because it's a much more highly addictive, much more potent drug. And then you look at, you know, methamphetamine, it's 10 times cheaper than it was 10 years ago, and it's almost 80 times stronger than it was 10 years ago. So that's wrong data. Sorry, 50 times stronger. And then, you know, now, we're legalizing marijuana, or marijuana is getting legalized, and marijuana is getting laced with fentanyl. We're seeing that here in our community right now, and kids are overdosing. And I say kids, 18 to 28-year-olds. I mean, that 10-year window is like they seem to be the target for the distributors, and they seem to be the group demographically that's really drawn towards, you know, all this mood altering opportunities. And I frame it like that because I don't want to pigeonhole or you know, profile anybody, because you watch the level of morbidity rate we have right now. It's not zip code specific. It's inner city, it's urban, it's country, it's mountain living, it's by the water, it's, you know, high net people don't have money. It doesn't matter. Drug addiction does not discriminate. Drug addiction does not discriminate. And I get concerned about it. And then, you know, we're watching vaping now. People are manufacturing THC to put it into the materials that are put in vaping pipes. And, you know, people are dying.
They're also vaping meth, which I guess now can mean that they're also vaping, oh my gosh, fentanyl. So, I mean, that whole thing is just like crazy. And they say that they didn't market to the kids on the whole vaping thing, but I really do have to kind of disagree with that when you have like bubblegum flavored, you know, I actually don't know what the vaping is, but the vaping juice or whatever. I mean, they definitely only marketed that towards people that were under the age of 40.
Well, you know, look, you know who controls most of the vaping industry is the old tobacco experts. I mean, right. So nobody knows how to bring a product to market better than they do. And, you know, but look, when vaping was started, it was to be, you know, an offset or alternative to tobacco consumption. So I think the theory behind it was sound. I've done a few pieces with the media about it, you know, and I don't want to tell a kid, don't do that. To me, that is a direct invitation to continue. Plus, when you're telling kids not to do something, their curiosity, in my opinion, organically goes up. Wait,
absolutely.
I never thought about it. Now I'm, why are you telling me I can't? I'm going to do some investigation. You know, and with the internet today, and by the way, speaking of the internet, the dark web today is where most of the people are getting a hold of fentanyl and all kinds of interesting products around THC globally. And it's amazing. So I think I've touched on most of it from, you know, traditional street drugs to prescription medication to counterfeit medication to what's going on with vaping and the things that are being put into medication that kids don't know that are there. That's why we're seeing this morbidity rate, because most people have given a choice. If you take this pill, you have a chance of dying. If you take this pill, you know, you're just going to be a little fuzzy for the next 10 to 12 hours. Which one would you take? No one's giving kids a choice. And unfortunately, they're being disguised in a way that if you're putting things in your body and you don't know where it came from, you better pause for a second. Because right now, that's the only safety valve you really have, in my opinion.
I would think the fentanyl issue would be a deterrent for kids. I mean, I get the curiosity thing. I totally do understand that. However, I mean, just the fact that, I mean, you could do it one time and that's it. And we've had, you know, several stars that have died from fentanyl and, you know, among that age group of kids. Well, I hate, you know, kids, you guys are kids if you're under the age of 40, as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I would be terrified to do any drug that I was, well, I mean, but that's kind of a lie, right? Because I overdosed on my trazodone. So, yeah. You know, and I, so.
Don't worry, I was going to call you on that. Because, you know, when you're actively involved, well, let me weed this. When we're actively involved in our drug seeking mode, I mean, I was taking pharmaceutical cocaine. I was taking 95% pure mescaline and LSD back in my day. Mushrooms that were grown by people in northern parts of the state, you know, high levels of THC, but that was nothing in those days compared to what's being, you know, grown today. But, you know, it's like when people ask me in interviews, they say, well, why would a drug dealer, okay,
why want to kill his client?
Well, right. I'll tell you something interesting, because I've spoken to and I've heard from the professionals who arrest these individuals. And one of the things that they're doing now and have been doing for quite some time is asking the question, because everyone's trying to understand, you know, what is a gateway drug? Is it really a gateway drug? What makes a gateway drug? And right now people think that vaping is now a gateway substance. So when asked the question, the aggressive distributor said simply, whatever fentanyl is in the news and somebody overdoses and dies from fentanyl, their answer is it's good for business.
Because it brings it out into the forefront.
Correct.
That's crazy. You know, that's, in my opinion, that's crazy.
I get it. No, I absolutely agree. And by the way, when I think about the work that I do as a crisis coach and a family navigator and somebody who runs an outpatient program, and I have this organization I'm associated with called SOAP, it's Society of Addiction Professionals, and I run another nonprofit called Safe Homes Coalition, which is a medication removal program. When I talk about this drug dealer who says that's good for business, that's my competitor. That is who in today's world in real time I'm competing with, because, and I'm not going to ever be able to stop them. I mean, the DEA, the Department of Justice, and all of the narcotics task force in the world are only catching about 5% of what's being made and distributed. So all I try to do is build awareness, intervene, you know, with my family navigating, work with families before it's too late, because I'm on this funeral avoidance campaign. Think about that when you even hear that out loud. Why would someone be on a funeral avoidance campaign? Because I'm tired of going to all these funerals and watching. You know, I was doing some, you know, yesterday was Yom Kippur, you know, the holiest day of the year for the Jewish people. And I was sitting in temple praying, and I was thinking about all the people that I've known and the families that I've spoken to. And I started to last night it was keeping me up thinking about all that. You know, when I talked to you earlier in this segment about the 240 people that die every day, if the average person, okay, has 4 to 5 people in their immediate family, and the average person has about, let's say, 40 friends, you know, close friends over time, and then they have another 40 or 50 associates, you add up all those numbers on a monthly basis. And I came up with this number in my head. That's 3 million people roughly a year that are impacted just by the daily overdosing and expiring from opioids. Now, if you factor in suicides, alcohol, other drugs, we're talking about maybe 5 to 20 million people a year that are impacted, meaning a family who loses a loved one, every family member, all the cousins, all the family, all the friends, all the friends of the friends, all the family of the family. You start doing the math, it might even be in the hundreds of millions.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it'd probably be a higher number than that. You know, start to think of the ripple effect of
exactly. And then when I get the one question I get asked every day is, Scott, what is going on? Because I've been talking about this publicly now for decades. And, you know, I've been a little ahead of the curve. And one of the factoids that's coming right now, you know, with Purdue, the manufacturer of OxyContin, you know, and the Sackler family and the horrible situation that's going on with them and the lawsuits, and they just filed bankruptcy. What if that company stops making OxyContin, which probably is going to happen on the reorganization? And who knows, maybe the DEA or the FDA or the CDC or the Surgeon General might put a cease and a halt to the manufacturing of OxyContin until they figured out how to remanufacture it and or distribute it in a safe way. Think about this. What about the people who actually need it? What about the people who are prescribed and under doctor's care? What if they can't get that medication anymore?
Right. So, I don't know. Yeah. Well, one of my bipolar groups, there was supposedly a letter that came out to doctors last year that actually said that OxyContin and other opioids were going to cease to be manufactured. So I don't know if that's true or not. I didn't look into it, but if it's not true, then it's a pretty scary rumor for all the people that do need it. And I don't know what people will do, like people that with back injuries or, you know, whatever it is that they need the actual medication for and are not abusing their medication. I have no idea what they're going to do. I mean, it's our suicide rate will probably increase at that point in time.
Well, that's exactly my point, because even if they stop making it, or if they don't stop making it, doctors right now, think about it. You're a doctor right now. You're being told that you're part of the problem because you've been prescribing the medication. Okay, so you slow down your prescribing. You're very careful about it. You dole it out in much smaller doses. You require your client to come back more frequently. Then you make them test to make sure there's no other substances. And God forbid you find out there's another source of medication in the person you're talking to because they have other doctors for pain or for other issues, and you doctors weren't talking to each other because doctors don't necessarily do that unless it's needed.
Wow, it's almost like somebody doesn't want this conversation to happen.
Are they just making us work really hard so we stay focused? There's another way of looking at it.
Maybe that's what it is. Anyway, so do you remember what you were talking about?
I do. So what I was saying was doctors who have been prescribing to their, you know, clients for so long are now being cautioned, warned, concerned. They're, you know, some cases paranoid because there's such a huge conversation about, you know, overprescribing. So they're being very cautious about it. And in some cases, so there's this liability now that doctors have if they keep dosing, they could be, you know, condemned as drug dealers. And I can't tell you how many families I've heard when they say to me, you know, my wife or my husband, doctor is a drug dealer, you know, she had an injury or he had an injury 10 years ago and they keep prescribing or they keep their loved one keeps manipulating the doctors. You know, they have the hypocritic oath to basically say, you know, if your threshold of pain is X, we're going to give you a prescription. If you can't sleep at night, we're going to give you a prescription. If you need to wake up, we're going to give you a prescription. So that's kind of been the modality for so long. I mean, in 2016, Don, listen, it's 2016, 264 million. That's 264 million prescriptions for OxyContin were written. Not pills, prescriptions. 2016, wow. That was just 3 years ago. So the other side of the doctor issue is that the doctor says, wait a second, you know, patient of mine, I have been told, our industry's saying, you know, we've been going to conferences, we're being told, we're getting, you know, American Medical Association says, the Surgeon General says, we must not continue to do this. The science shows that, you know, long-term pain treatment, OxyContin is no longer, you know, perceived as a tool that works. So now they decide not to write a prescription. Okay. Well, technically that's malpractice, just like overprescription is malpractice. So doctors today are in a very precarious position because what do they do? And let's look at these pain docs. Some of the doctors who specialize in treating pain, who have caseloads of 500, 1,000 or more people, what are they going to do?
Right.
So we're, it's funny, all these years we've been watching these zombie movies. We're going to see this in real time. We're going to see people who don't know what to do, and they're going to start self-medicating. I mean, we're going to see, in my opinion, we haven't talked much about this, but we're going to see alcohol consumption go back up, in my opinion. We're going to see marijuana consumption, and not from a standpoint of casual consumption, but we're talking about self-medicating because someone says they can't sleep, they can't move, they can't breathe, they can't function.
They can't function.
And when they can't take their medication, they feel violent, or they feel sick, or they can't leave the house. Their depression increases. Whatever happens, people aren't just going to sit there in pain and go, I'm going to accept this pain and I'm going to breathe through it. I remember I was at a conference 4 years ago, listening to these two pain doctors going, we think the best alternative right now to opioids is yoga.
Really? For somebody that like is physically unable to move and they're going to go start doing. Yeah. I mean, I get the mindfulness thing. I understand that because that can probably help. But yeah, I'm not sure that yoga is actually the next best thing to medication.
They were asked the question, what's the best alternative? And they were, mindfulness was also suggested, medication, journaling. But let me tell you something. If you're used to taking 300, 400, 500 milligram of opioids every day, and now you're down to 60 or 70 or not at all, or you're being told take ibuprofen, psychologically, that separation anxiety, especially if you're addicted to it, you're not going through a formal detox
process, right.
You're going to be in a living hell. So I'm really worried about societally right now because no one's jumping in with solutions. And to be honest with you, a traditional treatment provider like myself, who doesn't offer medication-assisted treatment to somebody who's going through withdrawal like that, we're putting people in harm's way. It'll be an outcome of a catastrophic event that, in theory, could create an even larger catastrophe.
Heroin epidemic. So it's kind of like a catch-22 here. So right. they're lesser prescribing a medication. We'll call it a medication, and for the people that are not abusing it, who need it. Then now they're going to be cut off from it. And this has already happened in Arizona where I'm at. We've lost our one doctor that we had on the mountain I live on. And everybody that was on OxyContin, he also did Suboxone. And I think he wrote the scripts for methadone. And he was actually, he's in jail actually for overprescribing is what happened. But all these people were left cold turkey. And the influx of heroin that happened after this was insane. And then the amount of suicides that we have on the mountain also rose, but the death rate from the heroin, the fentanyl laced heroin is skyrocketing on the mountain I live on right now. So it's a terrible catch 22. I mean, maybe they're going to come up with a medication now that isn't addictive to help people with pain, which, that would be a miracle. I don't even know if that's possible.
I don't know. It's a great question. And, what scares me when you describe what you just heard, you just said, and I just heard it. Let's go back to what I was saying earlier about who my biggest competitor is. When it hits the news, okay, and it does, or when it hits the streets and the noise goes out there and people are screaming that, our doctor they took our doctor, you know, their doctor was arrested, or our distribution point, or the pharmacy that was has decided to stop, you know, selling opioids.
Right.
Because insurance won't pay.
They're getting robbed. Right. They're also getting robbed for it. So, yeah.
So what happens then is the distributors around the country, they see that as a marketing opportunity. They'll come to your town anywhere, USA. They don't care. They'll send somebody in an RV and go over to the mountain, ask for Don, you know, and then, you know, or Don's friend, or just go park at, you know, a coffee shop or a fast food restaurant and set up a little sign that says, no oxy, no problem.
Right. Right. I'm sure that's probably exactly what happened, because once the demand was there, again, I'm not in that scene, and I'm so grateful that I'm not in that scene. But because of, you know, my past drug abuse, I'm still part of the circle, if you know what I mean. So it's kind of like, you know, I hear that. So what do you think is missing from society then, that we're all, well, not all of us, but the drug seeking that's going on? Do you think that, like, it's church or family or all of that? People just feeling alienated, possibly social media could be leading to part of this. I mean, what do you think is missing from our society?
Well, you know, the thing that's interesting about social media and, you know, obviously the internet that didn't exist in my day, is the information highway is so real time, meaning you can go on and you can Google almost anything you want. Well, you can Google anything you want. You get answers in a matter of seconds. And what happens when you Google a headline, like, where do I get XYZ? It'll pop up, and it won't just pop up with 100 hits. It'll be like 3 million, 4 million, 20 million. So it's not, if someone's seeking, it's, and look, unfortunately, you look at the news today. I mean, every time, look, I'm a subject matter expert right here in San Diego with our local KUSI television station. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some weeks they want me to talk about it once or twice. Some months they don't want me talking about it. I mean, it's just so horrible. I mean, when you think about the morbidity rate, and some of the data right now, we have a prescription drug abuse task force in San Diego. The data right now comes from the medical examiner. I mean, people are going right from consumption to overdose to morbidity to dying, and then autopsy, and then the information comes. That's where the real-time data is coming, and it's scary. And, you know, by the time somebody gets there, and everybody has to go through that, you know, it's one of those things, if you die accidentally or on purpose, it gets examined by some public municipality, and that data gets captured. I mean, the DEA just revealed a report a few months ago, because they had a 10-year document that was just released publicly a few months back, because every pill that the Purdue manufactured, the Sackler family, the OxyContin, any other, all those scheduled drugs, narcotics, they're dialed in with a DEA number from the point of manufacture to distribution to pharmacy to script writing to deliverable to the consumer. It's tracked. The DEA knew for years that this little town, what was it, Virginia, you know, a town of 800 or something, where 5 million pills were sold in one pharmacy.
Wow.
They knew it, because it was tracked. It was data that was real-time capturing, but no one reacted to it because the lobbyists were so strong. So something's really got to change at a higher level, in my opinion. And, you know, and people, they want to blame the doctors who write the scripts. Some people want to blame the pharmacies because they fill the scripts. Some people want to blame the insurance companies because they pay for the prescriptions. But at the end of the day, as consumers, if we have this information that what we're taking is going to kill us, and we clearly know that. But you remember that campaign years ago, just say no to drugs. This is your brain for drugs. That is
Nancy Reagan. Yeah.
The studies show that increased consumption, because it built a form of indirect awareness that, oh, wow, you mean I can make my brain feel like a scrambled egg, even though I hate, I hate eggs? I mean, like,
wow, they really don't want us talking about this.
Hello?
I
got you.
I can barely hear you. All right, cool. All right, well, so third time's a charm here.
I can't hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you just fine.
Okay.
So let's just finish this up. Is there anything else that you want to promote about yourself, your book, or the recovery place, your phone number for the crisis counts? What is
Sure.
your
Let me just, yeah, I'll share my information. My book's called Tell Me No, I Dare You, and it's kind of about my journey and the people I served. And Tell Me No, I Dare You is the book you can get on my website. That website is yourcrisiscoach.com, yourcrisiscoach.com. And then I'm going to give you my number again. It's area code 619-993-2738, 993-2738. And I dare people to call me or text me. And look, if you're sitting in Texas or you're in Florida or New York or Boston or Chicago or the Dakotas or Oregon, it doesn't matter. You can call me, you can text me, you can email me. And most of my coaching work, Dawn, is done by phone. So that's something. And then what I can do is help you as a family navigator get into a path of how to get resources or how to talk to people or how to ask for help. And I'll be your family navigator. Let me help you with that. I mean, I do it professionally, but I'm happy. Anyone who hears my voice on your podcast, you call me, I'll give you a 10-minute free now, FREE, which is my second favorite F word, a free coaching call so we can at least get you jump started. And if you want to utilize me or engage me, great. And if you don't, that's okay too. No obligation. So 619-993-2738. And you know what? I want to drink from a fire hose. So blow up my phone. Don, thank you so much for the opportunity today.
Scott. This has been wonderful, except for all the crazy tech issues. But I plan to have you on again and talk further, maybe about the opioid addiction problem and, what is going on with that.
Happy to do it.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Have a great rest of your day.
You too. Thank you.
So a big shout out to Scott Silverman. Thank you very much for putting up with the tech issues today and giving us a lot of valuable information in regards to addiction, mental health, and the epidemic that is happening in our country right now. So this is Dawn Shireen. This is my podcast. Everybody enjoy the rest of your National Mental Health Day. And hey, why don't we all just stay alive? Later.